first of all, lots and lots of people do drugs. And in the gay community, there are both, you know, stereotypes of gays using a lot of drugs and realities of gays, especially gay men using a lot of different kinds of drugs. I myself have used drugs and many kinds of drugs in my life, and certainly know a lot of people who haven't. I've experienced all the highs and lows of them, figuratively and literally.
Welcome to Queer Health Podcast.
QHP is a podcast about queer health topics for sexual and gender minority folks.
My name is Sam. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm a physician in training to be a primary care doctor.
I'm Gabby, she, her pronouns, and same job title as Sam, as usual.
And I'm Richard Green. I use he and him pronouns. I'm the director of LGBTQ clinical services at Bellevue Hospital in New York City.
And you're listening to Queer Health Pod, Season 2, Episode 1, Club Drugs. For the QHP superfans at home, you may have recognized that earlier voice at the top of the episode as Brad Locally, who joined us for our first ever episode on our first ever season of this podcast.
Brad, who could forget him?
My name's Brad Locally. I'm a stand-up comedian, television writer, theatrical writer, columnist, and large homosexual.
I hope that my homosexuality is never described as anything other than large.
Well, given that you host this podcast, I'm pretty sure you're manifesting that big gay energy just fine. Anyway, we loved hearing about what Brad put into one end of his body, so of course, we asked him back to hear about the other things he's putting into the other end.
Maybe putting into the other end. What we're trying to say is today's episode is about club drugs.
Cocaine, ecstasy, ketamine, GHB, bundles of sage burned as incense during a cleansing spell. Is that just me for that last one?
Gabby, your horoscope is showing. But on this episode, we'll share information and strategies that will make using these drugs, if you choose to do so, a little bit safer.
We're also going to touch upon how to take care of folks around you who may be using drugs, as well as some red flags to be on the lookout for.
And as always, we'll beg and plead that your affirming healthcare provider really actually does want to hear about which drugs you use, especially if it's this sage that Gabby is talking about that I haven't heard of yet.
You're not a Wiccan, obviously.
I actually dabbled in Wicca in my 20s, just FYI.
Ooh. Well, before I circle back to unpack that new piece of knowledge, if you've got a second right now, pause this podcast and subscribe to us on our streaming platforms at Spotify or Apple. Doing so makes me look good as a social media lady and also helps this information find a larger audience.
And this is The Daily. Just kidding. Don't sue us.
Okay, so here's my question. What makes club drugs a queer health topic?
I think we should have Brad lead us off on that one.
Well, I mean, like it or not, they go hand in hand. They go limp wrist and limp wrist. And I mean, again, let's let the lesbians off the hook for this. This is mostly, we're talking about gay male experience. There is a big difference when you go to like an all gay male nightclub versus when you go to an all lesbian event, so far as the drug and alcohol use and how it's being used and responses to it. They're just, not to live in the binary, because obviously there are binary people who move within both those communities. But the fact of the matter is, like, a giant gay circuit party is predominantly people who would identify as gay male. And, you know, the gay community, that kind of circuity party community, is drawn to club drugs.
All I'm saying is that Brad does not know what goes on in my queer ladies backgammon club. Just kidding. It's actually a knitting circle of one, me. I digress. Let's bring on one of our healthcare experts to talk a little more about this connection between queerness and club drugs.
I'm Perry Halkidis. I am the Dean of the School of Public Health at Rutgers University. I'm also professor of biostats and urban global public health, and I run a center called the Center for Health Identity, Behavior, and Prevention Studies, which is a biobehavioral research center focused on, you know, sexual and gender minority health. All of my work for the last 25 years has really looked at the intersection of sexual behavior, mental health burdens in the population, and substance use, and the extent to which biological, behavioral, social, and structural factors drive quote-unquote risk behaviors, and primarily in the population of gay men.
Drugs, risk behaviors, social and structural factors? Tell me more.
Traditionally, quote, club drugs, end quote, included substances like cocaine and ecstasy, which were used by folks for their stimulant properties in order to stay awake for the parties.
But in the year of our Lord 2023, the term club drugs can include a lot more than just uppers like Coke and E.
In my perception, the term relates to drugs that are used in the population of LGBTQ people, which facilitate sexual behavior, which are associated with the term chemsex, you know, sex under influence of chemicals, that heighten the sensation of sexual behavior, that disinhibit people and allow them to engage in certain kinds of behaviors, and that, you know, sort of escalate, elevate, heighten the sensations associated with sex.
The good old S word.
Sensations.
Sage.
No. Sex.
I don't think the term club drug is appropriate anymore because, you know, it just assumes that people just use these drugs in clubs. And in fact, we know that people are using drugs like meth and ecstasy and K and G and others, Molly, in their homes or at partners' homes or what have you. But now here's the more provocative thing that I want to put out there, which is, you know, why isn't alcohol a club drug? Because alcohol is probably the drug that's used the most in our population of LGBTQ people. It is a drug that people often turn to facilitate sexual behavior, to disinhibit themselves. So why is that not a club drug? Because it's a sanctioned drug? I'm saying that in a provocative way because I would like the audience to start thinking about any kind of substance that people use in relation to their lives and to their behaviors, which ultimately is very linked to partying and sexual behavior. So these are feel-good party drugs, right? Alcohol and poppers and meth and K and pot could be part of that mix.
The through line Dr. Halkidis is describing and has studied for decades, by the way, is that how queer folks experience sex, the stigma, shame, resilience, pleasure, all of it, oftentimes pulls drugs, some sanctioned and some not so much, into the orbit of the queer experience.
Whether that explanation is consistent with why you or your friends use club drugs, it's worth noting that there is population-level data suggesting that queer folks use club drugs in higher frequencies than other identity groups, if you look at it by sexual orientation.
If you look at the few epidemiological studies that are out there, coupled by the numerous behavioral studies that are out there, there are certain substances that are used at higher rates, but it's hard to really decipher like what exactly those patterns are. I will make a more global comment, which is that there is a reliance on substances that takes place among sexual and gender minority people that might be higher than in non-sexual and gender minority people.
But let's be clear about something. This isn't about directionality or blaming an identity for a particular behavior. Rather, it's acknowledging how our lived experiences, how existing in the world with certain identities, can impact or influence our actions, proclivities, and behaviors, which is basically much more elegantly described by this concept called the minority stress theory.
So minority stress theory that's been postulated by several researchers, including Elon Meyer and others, argues that when a person is burdened because of who they are, whether it be their sexual identity or their gender identity or their race or, you know, their immigration status, a level of education, what have you, that those stressors created by society create burdens. And those burdens, if not handled effectively, i.e. if one is not resilient or has no levels of resilience, often leads to the risk behaviors, including substance use as a means of coping with those stressors. There is a reliance on substances as a means of coping for some SGM folks. I think it is normalized behavior in the SGM population. I think that context and social navigation and environments facilitate this. And I think there is a desire for a certain kind of sex that facilitates the use of this drug.
Certain kinds of sex. So like letting a feathered boa slowly fall from your shoulder, right?
Thanks for sharing your kink with us, Sam. But I think what he's talking about is how these massive expectations and experiences that make sex so emotionally loaded for people often end up pairing them with club drugs.
Also, like, it's drugs. Some people do them just for fun, sometimes because of stigma, and sometimes because straight people just don't know what poppers are yet.
The image of khakis, boat shoes, and poppers is concerning to me.
So now that we've got you thinking about lacrosse bros doing poppers, we can safely move into less traumatic territory, into a conversation on harm or risk reduction, which is just another way of saying lowering the chance that something bad or unexpected or undesired will happen when using drugs.
Here's how Brad approaches this.
I think it's better, in my opinion, to just teach people to try to be more responsible
and their irresponsible behaviors. You know what I mean? Everyone's going to speed when there's no one else on the road and they know there's not a cop. But we've all, you know, bred into our brains culturally the idea that speeding in the rain or in the snow is more dangerous. So I think risk mitigation, to me, should be the concern amongst like gay club drugs and gay partiers.
Risk mitigation, risk reduction, or in Brad's phrasing, potentially irresponsible things more responsibly done. All of these are a concern for our other expert guests today.
My name is Dr. Darian Sutton. I'm an emergency medicine physician. My pronouns are he and him.
Dr. Darian is an emergency medicine doctor, and he also goes by the same name, Dr. Darian, on Instagram, where he's actually kind of a celebrity. Whether online or in person, he spends a lot of his time talking about harm reduction.
The idea of risk reduction is really important and I think flies over the heads of many people. But what we as doctors are really trying to do is simply advise. We know we're not going to change whether or not you choose to use something, but how can you use it in the safest way possible? And the way that I educate my patients about that is simply by being simple. And by that, I mean picking one substance that you've decided to use and sticking to that. And understand that obviously each and every substance that people partake in comes with risk, but you increase your risk when you do polypharmacy substance use, which is introducing more than one drug into your system.
Brad rephrased that very bluntly.
Know who you're getting shit from, because none of this is FDA approved. So like a huge amount of cocaine in America right now is cut with fentanyl. And that's a huge problem for people who use cocaine, because fentanyl, first of all, is going to get you addicted to something that's completely unrelated to the cocaine plant. And it's more likely to kill you in the short term than you know, reasonably cut cocaine would.
As Brad alluded to, many advocates argue that drugs should be FDA approved, screened, and made available in safe supply. But we'll put a pin in that conversation for now.
And precisely because many of these drugs aren't regulated, Brad had some important advice about where you source your supplies.
First and foremost, don't buy drugs on the street, literally or figuratively, which is both a legal advice and medical advice. Anyone who is a legitimate purveyor of narcotics or illegal substances would not do transactions on a street corner. Like anything that looks like a don't do drugs video from the 80s, none of that. You should know who you're purchasing these things from, because especially a lot of these things like ecstasy and cocaine in particular can be cut with a lot of stuff.
So Brad's first rule, buy drugs in familiar or safe territory. Rule number two, use them in safe territory.
Know your environment. That's another big one when you're using any sort of substance, and your environment includes the people in your environment. So the first time you do acid, you should be in a control. The first time you do any drug, you should be in the control group. Anytime I've tried something new, I've never done it in an environment that I didn't think about its safety. So, you know, again, taking hits of acid while at the top of a skyscraper with no railing on the building would probably not be the best advice, as opposed to like in a lovely backyard pool surrounded by friends who, if you freak out, someone can say, hey, relax, you're just hallucinating because you took a hallucinogen.
Which brings us to rule number three, surround yourself with people you feel safe with.
Any substance should never be your first time with someone new. That should never be your experience. I think that that's really the main thing for me. The reason why is because I get so many patients who come in on late nights who have had experiences, unfortunately been exposed to violence and trauma that they were not planning on being exposed to, obviously, because they were partaking in a substance for the first time with someone that they did not know. So I'm not really concerned about the substance. I'm concerned about the person you're doing it with.
When we say people you feel safe with, we mean people who won't take advantage of you if you're intoxicated, or who you trust to do something if something goes wrong.
And you can take that one step further and include a babysitter or a designated driver, since one of the most common reasons for harm in club drug use is accidents that occur while people are intoxicated, but aren't really related to the drugs themselves.
Let's move into rule number four, which is, when possible, avoid mixing drug types.
So common things that I'll see people use, and I'll use the term uppers and downers to be as simple as possible. Sometimes people will use an upper and feel like they've gone too up, and then they'll try to combine it with a downer. I'll see patients that will use cocaine recreationally, and that is an upper. It is a stimulant, and they may feel as though they're too high up in the air, and so they want to get a downer, and they'll involve an opiate or a suppressant. That can be a choice of heroin or fentanyl, where they feel as though it relaxes them. but they may not realize that they're introducing more risk into them, into their health by combining these substances.
And I just want to say, you know, obviously, if you're talking to your doctor, the hope is you're talking about the drugs you're using and you're able to get answers about what you can and can't mix. But the list of things that you can and can't mix generally for any individual human being is so long that it's super helpful when folks are asking us about specific combinations. Because I might cover like 9 out of 10 hypothetical combinations in a general speech about mixing drugs, but I may not cover the one other combination that applies to you and your drug use. And so that is a way that if you're able to have that conversation with your physician or your provider, it can really help you make more informed decisions about what things to mix and to not mix.
One way to make sure you are not mixing unintentionally is to use drug testing.
They make tests that you can literally, you know, test the drug against it, or you can break off some of a pill or take some powder or liquid and just put in a little water and put the urine strip in. It'll test positive. In my experience, it'll test positive or negative. So for things like cocaine right now, there's a new kind of epidemic amongst people who use cocaine in America, and it's really a fentanyl problem. It's not a cocaine problem, and it's fentanyl being in cocaine. So even if you really trust someone, you should still be testing what you get. If you're willing to spend $200 or $300 or $400 or $500 on an 8-ball of cocaine or on a bag of pills or on a, you should be willing to spend, you know, $5 or $10 per test just to test that batch.
I do want to be clear. Really, any drug tests are not definitive. They are not a guarantee of what you are taking. They are not a purity test.
But today we're in the business of harm reduction, and drug tests, even if they're imperfect, are a step in that direction.
And my personal perspective is any layer of risk reduction or mitigation is better than nothing.
With those risk reduction tools under our collective queer belt.
Actually, I feel that belts are distinctly butch.
I think we have different belt styles in mind, but I'm not going to fight you on this, Gabby. But my point is that we want to talk about what to do when something bad or unexpected goes down after using drugs, whatever your belt style is aside.
We can start with the most obvious way that drug use can go wrong, which is overdoses.
I'd say the truth is overdoses are kind of the easiest thing to intervene in because they tend to be dramatic. And they're definitely life or death. You know, I do think someone living should be the biggest concern. You know, I do think Rick surviving his overdose should be the biggest concern. Even if that means one person calls 911 and stays with the person and everybody else leaves the party, because it's going to take 20 minutes for the EMTs to get there anyway. So maybe the party should be over when Rick ODs. That should be the last call for the party.
Calling 911 can be a fraught choice, but as Brad pointed out, folks who want to leave and may not feel safe around the police will have time to leave before they arrive, but it's really essential to get the help that you need.
If the cops show up to your house and they now have been invited in with the EMTs to your house and your entire place looks like, you know, the second half of Boogie Nights and there's just drugs everywhere and it looks like a Scarface party, the cops might have something to say about it. I can tell you I've been with a lot of people in the emergency room who have OD'd. And I've never seen any of them wake up with handcuffs on. If they just show up and somebody has done drugs and is in medical need, it's going to be a medical issue, not a police issue. And I think people do confuse that. I think people think that if you go to the hospital when you're on drugs, you're going to wake up with handcuffs on. And the police are going to be like, why did you take acid? Why were you doing cocaine? That's not how real life works.
And if you are going to call an ambulance, here's what to expect.
So call 911 and then check the person. Are they breathing? Do they have a pulse? And when you call 911, if you put it on speaker, they will help direct you in what to do. And it will help take some of the pressure off of you. But again, do not feel fearful if you're using a substance. And we can go down and talk about the legal repercussions. But honestly, for patients and my personal experience in New York and here in California, is that patient just gets brought to the hospital and then gets left there to be treated by the medical personnel. It's not something where the police wait around to figure out what you were using or who used it. No one's really asking those questions. The simple fact is that our goal is to get you to be back to life. So hopefully people realize that, like, when you call 911, it's not going to be police showing up, although they may be there if they're the closest. The goal is not to arrest you. The goal is to take you to the hospital. And most patients get left there alone.
police presence can be really harmful if you're a person of color or someone of another minoritized group. And we know that there's significant discrimination. So have a plan to get out if something goes wrong. But whoever has overdosed absolutely needs the first responders, whoever they might be.
Since we're talking about overdoses, let's get into some specific scenarios and what to do if you encounter them. First up is seizures, which can happen from overdoses from drugs like G, ketamine, or more rarely, Molly.
Seizures are terrifying to watch. They're traumatic to see, and they're scary as hell. If you notice they're having a seizure, put a pillow under their head. If you notice that they're biting their tongue, do not put your hands in their mouth. Not only might you lose a finger, but you might cause them to choke some more. Some tactics that I like to do with patients who are having seizures is a chin thrust. You can Google jaw thrust if you're curious about how to do this, but it's really helpful and it helps people to prevent themselves from choking. And of course, before you do any of this, call 911.
Where seizures can be a common side effect of too much GHB, drooling and the choking that it can cause are things to keep an eye out for when you're using ketamine.
It can cause salivation, which many people don't think is a big deal. But if you feel disassociated and mildly sedated and you're salivating or drooling a lot, that can cause you to aspirate or choke. So make sure that you pay attention when you're using it and make sure that you pay attention to the dose, because small increases in the amount that you're taking can have really drastic effects on the body.
Let's move on now to ecstasy or Molly.
I had a patient who was a babysitter and had come in with symptoms of increased heart rate, confusion, and a syndrome called serotonin syndrome. And so Molly or ecstasy can basically hit these receptors that cause inappropriate release of serotonin, which can have really dangerous effects. And in that case, the babysitter was eating what they thought was candy, and it ended up being ecstasy. And they overdosed on it and required an admission to the hospital.
This serotonin syndrome that Dr. Darian describes can happen if you're taking too much Molly on its own, but it can also occur if Molly is taken by someone who is on other medications with effects on serotonin, like certain antidepressants and even some uncommonly used antibiotics.
I do want to make the point that if you're drinking a lot of alcohol, if you're using other recreational drugs, you might be sweating and you might need to drink some water. But drinking too much water can dilute the electrolytes in your blood to dangerously low levels because you're drinking faster than your kidneys can put the water out, which can result in seizures or even brain damage.
So please, if you feel like someone is going for their fifth, sixth, seventh glass of water at the bar and you know they're on Molly or ecstasy, please make sure you take the water out of their hand and give them something like Gatorade, Powerade, or Pedialyte, something with salt and electrolytes in it, so they're not just diluting what's in their blood.
On a side note, it does feel really good to be using the word electrolyte earnestly, because Gwyneth Paltrow has really taken that from me.
But I love Gwyneth.
DM us for our deeply felt multidimensional responses to Goop.
Actually, don't, because I'm manning the DMs and this is an emotionally fraught conversation for me.
When it comes to overdoses from opioids like fentanyl, heroin, or pills like Percocet and Vicodin, the thing to focus on is people's breathing rate. People who have taken too much of an opioid will breathe much more slowly, slowly enough that they may not be able to get enough oxygen to their brains.
This is a fantastic time for me to mention Narcan kits. Narcan is a nose spray that you can get for free over the counter at a pharmacy. It's super easy to use, and it will directly reverse the action of any opioid. So it's really useful in the overdose of things like fentanyl, morphine, heroin, or Vicodin. And it really is something that, because it's so easy to use and so effective, should be around when any drug is being used, especially given the fact that so many drugs these days are being laced with things like fentanyl.
Right, that person napping after they did a big bump of cocaine has ingested something other than just cocaine. If you use Narcan with someone and it looks like they've recovered, that's awesome. But they still need to go to the nearest emergency room immediately, because that Narcan can wear off and you can be back to exactly where you started without any Narcan to use.
We've just highlighted two specific scenarios, seizures and slow breathing from things like fentanyl. But there are a lot of times when, quote, too many drugs, end quote, doesn't fit a clear-cut picture or set of symptoms. All you're seeing is someone who's really intoxicated. Dr. Darian has some wisdom on what to do in those scenarios, too.
I think that zone is what I call that observational zone. You know, as a friend, the best you can do is observe and simply wait. You can talk to them, switch their drink out, give them some water with a lime in it. You know, these are simple mechanisms that we do for all of our friends. But unfortunately, when someone is not well and they have capacity, meaning they understand their decisions and they can say yes to no and they clearly get it, then I think that you should just observe them. If you feel as though they're losing their capacity, and by that I mean they don't understand what's going on around them and they can't make their own decisions and their own valid thought process, that's concerning for me. And so then that's when I go, okay, we need help. This patient does not have capacity and I need to call 911 because I'm concerned that they may hurt themselves.
And while you're waiting for help, know that there is stuff you can do. For example, that time when Brad was in a room full of people who had accidentally snorted ketamine thinking it was cocaine.
One girl was 90 pounds and dragged herself into the bathroom, this sweet young girl who I had never met before, and puked so hard that she knocked the caps out of her teeth and didn't realize it and flushed them. And she's an adult film star and she had a shoot the next day. So now she also had no front teeth. So that was now a work problem. Two people in the room stopped breathing twice and I revived them. And they basically stopped breathing because they were so ketamined out, they exhaled and their body was forgetting to inhale. Their body was kind of so relaxed and so paralyzed by the anesthesia that they had just snorted that they were forgetting to breathe. And so I literally had to just like force them to remember to breathe. You know, so moments like that are very dramatic and you can intervene.
You can totally intervene, but so can trained medical professionals. So if someone's not responding or they've lost control over their body or they need their front teeth for that film shoot tomorrow, please consider calling 911.
Because here's one thing that no active bystander is going to do: impromptu cosmetic dentistry.
So mixing and not mixing is the big concern for me. And in my opinion, there's only a couple that really can't be mixed or that are highly, highly dangerous, even in singular dose.
What are those very dangerous combinations or the highly dangerous ones alone?
Highest on our list is GHB, or gamma hydroxybutyrate, and alcohol.
There's a reason GHB tastes like jet fuel and a burned Barbie doll. It's because it's a really harsh chemical to just be ingesting into your body.
The more biological take on GHB is that it tells receptors in the brain whose job it is to slow down to do just that, to slow down. And alcohol also works on these receptors, so you're getting double receptor stimulation, which normally double stimulation isn't the worst thing, but...
So in combination, they can really pump the brakes on very important functions in the brain, like breathing.
GHB really doesn't mix well with most things, including itself. GHB absolutely cannot be mixed with alcohol. I have seen people GL, which is truly just an overdose. Gay men don't like to use the word overdose, it seems, for most things. But G-ing out is overdosing. Any amount of alcohol with G can trigger a G overdose. And G, I've just also found to be really inconsistent. I've seen people who use G frequently and successfully so far as they don't have any problems. And then they get a bad batch, or they get a stronger batch or a weaker batch. And so these are people who are already using G in a way that they're like setting timers on their phones. They're measuring out to the milliliter. They're being as responsible as one could be for it. And it more oftentimes than not has negative effects. I've definitely watched a lot of people die on G, and I've watched a lot of people G out. I've been bitten by a lot of people accidentally who are in the middle of a G convulsion as you're trying to kind of keep them from hitting their head against the ground profusely.
In addition to the seizures that can accompany a G overdose, Dr. Darian brought up its effect on how fast you're breathing.
Most of the common problems with GHB comes because people mix them with other things. And so I honestly would say, do you have to be careful with anything and everything? Because it can sedate you very deeply and it can cause respiratory depression, aka your breathing rate will decrease to a rate that's not accommodating to your life and your body. And so that can cause death. And so GHB, especially avoid anything that is a downer.
Other downers we wanted to mention are alcohol and benzos and opioids.
Benzos include things like Xanax and Clonopin, and opioids include things like pills, Percocet, Oxy, or also substances, fentanyl and heroin.
All of those drugs can slow your breathing rate, and in combination, they can slow it even more, which is the most common reason that someone might die of an overdose.
Now, on the other side of downers are uppers.
Please welcome to the stage, cocaine. Should I say that faster? Please welcome to the stage, cocaine.
Stop grinding your teeth.
Those who use cocaine, I would say understand your risk factors. If you are older, if you have a strong family history of cardiac disease, or if you yourself are overweight or have a history of a prior cardiac issue like a heart attack or stroke, these are reasons why you should really, really take caution with that upper, because it can increase your risk of those diseases and unfortunately not only cause death, but cause lifelong harm, which is something that we're trying to prevent.
Dr. Darian also pointed out that even though cocaine isn't a downer, you can still overdose on it.
So the common effects of a stimulant like cocaine include increased heart rate, increased blood pressure. And so the effects that we look at is if you're having chest pain, pay attention to it. It's not something that's just anxiety. Get help as soon as possible. If you have changes in sensation, weakness, a headache, or dizziness, don't chalk it up to just saying, it's my mind, I'm paranoid. It might be a real medical problem. And be honest once you get to that doctor, because we really, really take to heart when someone says they've been using something like cocaine and they have chest pain. Our workup is usually a little bit more intensive, and it can help you.
And look, I acknowledge that this honesty is much easier to preach than practice, but that honesty point really does bear repeating. Letting your healthcare providers know if you have cocaine in your system may mean guiding you towards a more tailored workup, and it can also mean avoiding medications that could cause more harm. And it's especially important to know if there are multiple uppers in your system, as combining them can actually increase their side effects.
Adderall is something that people use very commonly. It is a stimulant. And unfortunately, if you have that in your system, it can last for a relatively longer time than you think. And by that, I mean it can be in your system when you don't feel the effects. And if you use that in combination with other stimulants like cocaine, you can potentiate the negative effects of cocaine that can cause permanent harm or injury. So those are reasons why you should be careful with that.
When using cocaine, avoid stacking the effects with other stimulant drugs, which is relatively straightforward. But less straightforward is mixing uppers with downers, specifically cocaine and alcohol.
As scientists, we understand cocaine and alcohol creates a substance called cogethanol, which can last in your system for even longer and unfortunately potentiate those risks that you see with cocaine more so in that patient than the person who chose one substance. You're spending the effort and the time in trying to get that high, and it's not doing anything in terms of giving you more effect. It's simply leaving cocaine in your system longer so that when you're not even feeling the stimulant, it's still affecting your body negatively.
So mixing downers and mixing uppers is maybe a little bit, you know, College 101 level for some folks.
Okay, so let's move into 201 and talk about some other more advanced combos that may also not mix.
Like, I guarantee you, when they made Viagra, they didn't test it against poppers. We found out that Viagra and poppers could kill you because gay men ended up in the ER having just done Viagra and poppers and were perfectly healthy and suddenly had a giant blood pressure drop.
They're actually the same mechanism. So it can dangerously drop your blood pressure and cause you to faint, hit your head. And so you really got to be careful if you're using these two medications together. And I know that they're often used together.
So we don't have data on how long after using poppers it would be safe to use Viagra. Just keep in mind that you may not feel the side effects of a drug like poppers, but it still could be active in your system.
I mean, and we can also counsel people, you know, many people have used Viagra and poppers together. It's not that every time you do that, it's instantly fatal. Some people have more experience than others, but you take these things slowly and understand what the consequences could be so you can take precautions against them.
Brad was very clear that he has often seen sleeping drugs mixed in folks who are coming down from things like cocaine or ecstasy because the high is over, but they still feel too stimulated to sleep.
So Ambien is a very strong drug, and all of those kinds of sleep, all of those kind of forced sleep, I consider them kind of anesthesia sleep pills. They're really kind of forcing you into an anesthetic form of sleep. When you start mixing them with that varying forms of narcotics of varying quantities, you see in my circle of friends, you've seen it in a lot of the overdoses and a lot of the comas and a lot of the unexpected deaths. And I think because it's a prescribed drug, once your doctor decides you should be on that drug, you know, you're just like, oh, I take this the same way I take blood pressure medication, the same way I take, you know, my migraine medication or something like that. And they are very different and they are very strong.
Okay, too much to summarize, so please just rewind if you want to hear it again. But in short, for the safest drug experience,
don't mix.
Don't overdose. Remember to get medical attention if it's needed or use a Narcan kit.
Don't chug excessive amounts of water. Get electrolytes in there, but do stay hydrated.
And hashtag goop.
Before we wrap up, which we promise we're going to do soon, we just want to make one last point about why we think club drugs is an important topic for queer folks.
Being queer can be fucking stressful.
And drugs can relieve stress.
Many folks just use drugs for fun, full stop. But everyone we spoke to made it clear that a little self-reflection on what drugs are doing for you and your mental health can't hurt.
Here's Brad.
So yes, drugs are not healthy for you. But yeah, be honest with your doctor, and how honest you are with your doctor, in my opinion, will always tell you how much you can trust your doctor by the response.
QHP is a power-sharing podcast that puts community stories in conversation with healthcare expertise to expand autonomy for sexual and gender minority folks.
Thank you to our community voice, Brad Locally, and our healthcare experts, Perry Halakidis and Dr. Darian Sutt. We would also like to thank our community reviewer who helped do these interviews and come up with the design for this episode, Eric Kutcher.
For more information on this episode's topic or other episodes and other topics, check out our website, www.queerhealthpod.com.
Help others find this information by leaving a review and subscribing on Spotify or Apple.
And despite that I've been called an awkward dad on social media, follow us at Queer Health Pod on both Twitter and Instagram.
I think it's more like confused grandpa.
Don't kink shame me again, please.
And thank you to Lonnie Ginsberg, who composed our theme music.
As always, opinions in this podcast are our own and do not represent the opinions of any of our affiliated institutions. And even though we're doctors, do not use this podcast alone as medical advice. Instead, please consult with your own healthcare provider.
Wait, khakis are straight? I have a lot of internal reflection to do.
On cis men, khakis are straight. Especially if they have pleats.
Oh, God.
Former Gap girl here.
There's a whole story in here about how I auditioned to be the Gap baby, but that's for another time. It's true.